Welcome to Awesome Movie Year, the podcast where we take a look back at an awesome year for movies, which is every year. My name is Josh Bell, film critic and writer, and I am joined by my co-host.
Now, Josh, if you're gonna do an intro, do it right. Welcome to Awesome Movie Year.
I knew something like that was coming.
I was trained to do these intros. You know, Gould and I toured around doing intros. He was just the most wonderful man I've ever met.
Is that all you got?
Oh, yeah, that's one. I think that's enough for now.
Yeah.
Josh? David? Oh, am I glad to see you guys. You're not going to believe what's going on. The marble fawn is moving in.
So that's Jason Harris, co-host of Awesome Movie Year.
Yeah, I think I've shot my shot on
you
this
have
one,
indeed.
Josh.
I'm sure we're going to hear more of this, though, because in this season of Awesome Movie Year, we're talking about the films of 1975. And in this episode, we are talking about our documentary pick, which is Grey Gardens from the Maisels Brothers, featuring Big Edie and Little Edie, the Beals, as Jason so effectively illustrated there. I feel like I'm watching the movie again just by listening to you.
You know, Josh, as you know, there was a musical that played on Broadway and won awards, but maybe it's time I do a one-man show of Grey Gardens.
I feel like that's probably also something that exists somehow. I feel like there has to be some like drag performer or something like that who has taken inspiration from Grey Gardens to do a one-person show. It just seems like something that could not possibly not exist.
Yeah, I think this definitely has that kind of like, well, not just love from like the LGBTQ community, but also just in general, like kind of like the Golden Girls, you know, everyone can enjoy this thing, Josh.
Yes, much like the Golden Girls. So, and if you're not familiar, the Grey Gardens is the name of this dilapidated mansion in East Hampton, New York, where Big Edie and Little Edie, mother and daughter, are living and have lived for 50-ish years, I think, at the time that they were filming this documentary in 1974, initially. And they are relatives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, which is why they were renowned at the time, why the Maisels had heard of them and had an interest in making a film about them. And they had made headlines a few years earlier because of the incredible decrepit state of their home had led the local, I guess, was it the health department to attempt to evict them and basically condemn this property?
Yeah, I think so. Jackie O, obviously Bouvier, right, back in the day.
Yes.
She said that Big Edie was her favorite aunt growing up. So when that condemnation came down, Jackie O and one of the other cousins decided they would pay to have the place cleaned and up to code so that the ladies could continue living there with their house guests, which included raccoons, mice, and other animals.
Just like Disney princesses hanging out with animals. Yeah, and we see some of this at the beginning of the documentary. You know, the Maisels are known for this direct cinema approach, so there's no narration, there's no like talking head interviews, but they do show us a bunch of these newspaper headlines at the beginning to give you some of that background about the health department coming in and about Jackie and her sister, Lee Radziwill, coming in and helping with this cleanup. And Grey Gardens, the film as a project, began with Lee Radziwill, who's, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right, but who is Jackie's sister, who had commissioned the Maisels to make a documentary, not just about the Beals, but about the family in general in 1972, and it included footage of the Beals. And she eventually abandoned that idea, and the Maisels were so taken with the Edies that they went and got their own financing and returned in 1974 to film what became this film.
Yeah, Josh, interesting that you give her the Radziwill, but you know, Maz Mikkelsen, huh? That's how we're doing this
one. I'm trying to pronounce the names properly. I may be pronouncing her name wrong. I don't know. I looked up how to pronounce his name.
So Radziwill brought the Maisels out to East Hampton and said, hey, there's so much you can film here. And they started doing it. But I think he said they just got to the point where they're like, this is the documentary, the Big and Little Edie and Grey Gardens. And as you mentioned, the estate, the house is named Grey Gardens. Did you know it was it got that name because the original red paint was turned completely gray after an acid rainstorm.
Wow, that is so intense. this house even
feels appropriate.
Yeah,
right?
And even aside from the Beals, it just has this grand history, which is amazing, really. So yeah, you know, I always love when watching movies like this, or like I always think of Hitchcock's Rebecca, where they have Manderley, and I always remember, like, you know, you're rich when your house has a name, you know.
Yeah, my grandparents had a summer house, and what was it? Southwind, was that the name of the place in Gone with the Wind?
No, I don't think that's right, but maybe.
Oh. They had like a sign out front, and I remember it was like a street sign that was like the name of, I thought, from Gone with the
Wind.
It
could be.
But
it's been
a
while, but I feel like that might be something else. But I definitely always remember Manderley from Rebecca because it's the opening line from that film. Anyway, although the Beals were rich at one time, of course, as we see them in this film, they've the only wealth they have is tied up in the home that they're unwilling to sell, that even in its dilapidated state has this theoretical value. But Big Edie is unwilling to ever sell this house, and in fact was living in the house until her death.
Yeah, it is great. It's 12 Oaks from Gone with the Wind, which was not what this one was called. I'll have to find out. Now I want to know, because I can see the sign so clearly, Josh.
Yeah, it's those memories, the line between the past and the present, as Little Edie might say.
But can you do it with the voice?
I can't.
Josh.
I'm not going to even try. I'll leave that all to you. But this film premiered at the 1975 New York Film Festival, and it also played at the 1976 Cannes Film Festival, although it was out of competition, and at a couple other festivals as well. And the Maisels were kind of superstars of documentary before this, even having made Salesman and Gimme Shelter, which are, along with Grey Gardens, like three of the most famous documentaries of all time.
And we talked about them in our Pennebaker episode because they worked with him also on a number of different projects.
Yeah, and we should also note that along with David and Albert Maisels, Ellen, and here's another name for me to mispronounce, Ellen Hovde and Muffy Meyer are credited as co-directors of this film. And the Maisels often, the brothers and then Albert Maisels in his solo career after David died, were frequently, if not almost always, working with co-directors who never quite get the same level of acclaim that they get.
Yeah, well, you know, let's move on.
Okay, you don't want to give them credit.
No, I want to give them credit. I mean, it's, you know, look, I don't have an answer for that. I think we can kind of look at the obvious reasons in the 70s why they might have not gotten that credit, but we obviously want everyone to get
that. Yeah, and I mean, there is that obvious reason, but also the fact that the Maisels had, at a time long before documentarians or documentary filmmakers were well known, had kind of made this name and made this brand for themselves.
And we talked about this in City of God. That was a co-directed piece, but we really know it as the male director's project, right?
Yes, that is true. And I mean, I don't believe the Maisels themselves were ever accused of any sexist behavior per se, but it is true that these often female collaborators don't quite get the credit. Charlotte Zwerin, I know, is a big one, who was the co-director on Gimme Shelter and worked with them a lot as well. And this movie itself was, even at the time, sort of controversial a bit in terms of whether it was exploiting the Beals, and critics, whether they liked the movie or didn't like the movie, generally kind of engaged with that idea. Roger Ebert said, "Grey Gardens, one of the most haunting documentaries in a long time, preserves the Beals' strange existence, and we're pleased that it does. It expands our notions of the possibilities. It's about two classic eccentrics, two people who refuse to live the way they're supposed to, but by the film's end, we see that they live fully, in ways of their own choosing. And out of this existence comes a movie that, curiously enough, is comic and bright, as well as sobering. It's hard not to find these two odd women likable."
Oh yeah, they're very likable. I just love watching them and love watching them interact with each other, because they both have, you know, they're both alphas and they both have like their own agenda to get across, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I do think they're likable or sort of endearing in their own way. I think after 95 or whatever minutes of this documentary, I was ready to say, okay, I've spent enough time with the Beatles. They're exhausting. And that's not a criticism necessarily of the film. It accurately depicts what it might be like to spend time with these women, but I think it is enough. A little goes a long way.
I found it. I mean, I can understand how you could think they're exhausting. I mean, they make life tougher on themselves than it has to be, right?
Yeah.
But I just like love this. Like they're so, you know, out of time, out of place, from a different time. They just live in their own world. And I was just kind of mesmerized by it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. It is mesmerizing. I just think that at a certain point, definitely toward the end of this film, I was like, okay, I get it. I've had my fill of them. But you don't feel that way, obviously. And a lot of people, I mean, this is, I think part of the reason that it's acclaimed is not just for its place in documentary filmmaking, but because there's so much goodwill for the Beatles.
I think so, right? They became, Little Edie, who lived another, 25 years or so, 27 years. Yeah. She became kind of like an icon of sorts after this.
Right. Yeah, and that makes sense that people would be drawn to it in that way. So Janet Maslin in the Boston Phoenix had a slightly different perspective. I thought this was interesting. She said, as someone who has in the past despised the exploitative documentaries of the Maisels brothers, I feel that in Grey Gardens, they have for once found a subject which benefits from their viewpoint. These two dotty, hermetic old ladies sound like just the material for male Maiselsian manipulation, right? Well, I've got a theory. I think the brothers started shooting with that idea, but somewhere along the way, they had a Langian epiphany. They realized that these two women, with their 10 cats and continual bickering, had achieved a kind of sanity. What's more, mother and daughter had experienced the same tragedy. Each had been sidetracked from a show business career. And so, acting for the camera, even being unnatural, the kinds of things that happen only because the subjects are aware that they're being filmed, actually helped shape a truthful picture of this very odd couple.
So one, they were paid for participating, yes. Right? So we have to say that. So they agreed to it. They were paid for it. So I think you could, if your argument is, hey, they weren't exploited because of that, I think that's fair at that point. But I also agree, like you could sell, especially with Little Edie, like she loves the camera. She's been clamoring for this for years. Like she loves the attention. And, you know, this was probably the most exciting thing that happened to him in a long, long time.
Yeah. And I think I can understand the instinct to say that these are people who are mentally ill in some way and that the Maisels are taking advantage of that in a look at this horrible train wreck manner. But I think maybe because there are so many worse examples of something like that over time, it strikes me as minor. And also, like you point out, not only are they being paid and they continue to participate in the profits of what became a very successful film, but they love performing. You know, they feel good about being on camera there. And Little Edie, especially, there are moments, I think, in this where she's clearly putting on the performance to the point where she finishes and then she's like, how was that? What did you think? You know, she's starring in the film as far as she's concerned.
And she's flirting with the brothers, the filmmaker. And I just think that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, it's the 70s, but I feel like it's very clear that they knew what they were getting into and really, you know, were all in on that.
Yeah, I think so, to the extent that it is possible. So,
wait, Josh, I have a question for you, because like you, have you seen Salesman?
I have. I actually saw Salesman at the TCM Film Festival with Albert Maisels there, like a couple years before he died.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I like Salesman. It's another good documentary. But you know, I mean, and then you're talking about Give Me Shelter, but what do you think Maslin's referring to in exploitative documentaries of their past? Because, I mean, I've only seen bits and pieces of Give Me Shelter, but I don't think Salesman was exploitative at all.
Well, I didn't delve into this deeply, but I did kind of glance through the Salesman references. And in that case, I believe there's scenes where the salesmen travel to like Florida to go try to find a new market to sell in or whatever. And the Maisels finance that trip. And so you could argue that they're interfering or that they're crafting the film in order to place these subjects in an environment where they know they will get a certain result, and the result will be potentially humiliating for those subjects. It's been a long, you know, I haven't seen it. It was like 10 years ago that I saw it, so I don't remember every single detail. I could imagine that that might be the case. I mean, with Gimme Shelter, the obvious thing is that people died, and you know, they sort of use that as a selling point for the film.
I guess the word exploitative, maybe I'm thinking of it differently, because like I very clearly remember a bulk of salesmen taking place in Florida, right? And I can agree with you, like, hey, they're trying to craft their story the same way we talk about Michael Moore, but I don't think they're exploiting them. Maybe they're putting on an experiment to get the best product, but I don't think they're exploiting them. And like I said, obviously, we don't. I mean, that is more exploitative to say, like, come see the documentary where someone dies.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and I think these are criticisms that continue to come up. Obviously, these movies have stood the test of time. I mean, what Janet Maslin was saying in 1975 is something that I think has, to at least to some degree, fallen away. And we still think of these three films as some of the greatest documentaries ever made. But I think it's a legitimate question to raise.
Right. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, in Salesman, we don't hear the Maisels and they're not like kind of interacting with their subjects. And in this one, they're definitely kind of egging them on.
Right. And it's impossible for them to sort of not, because little Edie especially is trying to talk to them all the time and they can't not respond. So
I just not respond.
You did. Yes. You're the Maisels brothers of podcasting.
Just because I'm exploiting you.
You are. Everyone's listening to this podcast to laugh at me. That's the secret of Awesome Movie Year.
Hey, don't tell everyone. Yeah. We don't want them to know why they're listening, as long as they're listening.
Yeah. So Charles Michener in Film Comment also engaged with some of these issues. He said, shot over a period of several months and edited in free-flowing scenes to convey the time suspended, nearly stagnant whirlpool of life inside the haunted house, Grey Gardens raises in high relief the usual vexing questions of cinema verite. How much are the filmmakers manipulating, exploiting their subjects? And how much are the subjects manipulating, exploiting them? As the battle of nerves and wills rages, what has been implicit all along becomes clear. If the Maisels have been exploiting their subjects, the subjects have been exploiting them as well. And it's a tug of war of equals. For in Edith and Edie Beale, the Maisels are luckily contending with subjects that every cinema verite film must have to succeed. Brilliant, genuine performers.
Right. We know this more from reality TV now, where people are really just mugging and don't mind playing the villain or whatever it is. But Albert Maisel said when they, because, you know, obviously they asked him about this. As for the Beals being mentally ill, he said, as someone with a background in psychology, I knew better than to claim that Beals were mentally ill. Their behavior was just their way of asserting themselves. And what could be a better way to assert themselves than a film about them asserting themselves? Nothing more, nothing less. It's just them. They were always in control.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's fine to say that, like, maybe they are mentally ill, but it's not the Maisels' responsibility to treat that mental illness. They're not doctors. They're not psychologists.
Right. So is that then it becomes like, oh, well, should you be documenting that? But I mean, as we said, they seem to enjoy it. And we all have our own mental illnesses to deal with, don't we, Josh?
Sure we do. Not all of us get to star in documentaries about them.
Josh, in that review, he used the term a haunted house. And did you know that little Edie claimed that the house was haunted by the ghost of a sea captain who used to climb a ladder into her room for midnight trysts?
So she was having sex with a ghost?
I don't know, but he at least climbed the ladder and tried.
Okay, I missed that. That wasn't in the movie, was it?
No, this was in some research. She also claimed that it was haunted by like another... like maybe a mother and daughter, but there was no record that they had actually lived there. So, you know, whatever, the legend, the truth, it's all the same, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, as far as these people are concerned, I think so. It's all about, it's all performing as these reviews talk about.
Yeah. The whole world's a stage, Josh.
So that's a good quote from Edith Beale, I think. So Jason, I know you were excited about talking about this film because you had seen it before and really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one, and I believe, didn't Harlan County, USA come out in 75 also?
I don't know. I think we had one other. If it wasn't that, it was another, like, fairly major documentary that we were looking at versus this.
But right, if you're a documentary or a film fan, these are ones you got to check off your list, yeah. Right? You know, and so I did that. I think last year I watched it for the first time. I don't know what spurred me on to do it other than like I knew that I should watch it at some point in time and I just loved it. And I still love it. And I could watch it again next year and I think I would love it again.
Yeah, I am not as enthused as you are, but I mean, I did enjoy watching it. I found it fascinating to watch, certainly. Like I said, I've seen Gimme Shelter and I had seen Salesman, you know, in a great environment, obviously, with Albert Maysles there a couple years before he died. And I found those films interesting as well. And this is one I think I'd had on my list. Like you said, it's if you're a film fan, it's something to check off the list. And I had it in mind to watch for a long time. And this was a good opportunity to do so. Had you ever seen this one, Dave?
I hadn't. And I found it, like you, Josh, like I found it more interesting than anything. But I'm glad to have finally gotten to it.
Yeah. Had you seen any Maysles Brothers films?
No, I was looking at the list. I don't think I've seen any of them, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, those three are really the most famous. And a lot of other stuff they worked on is more like lost to history. Although Albert Maysles, I mean, we'll talk about later, but the documentary he made about Iris Apfel in 2014 got a lot of attention. I feel like that was a big resurgence after years.
And that was a good one.
It was a good one. Yeah, I've seen that one as well. And that is a good one, definitely. So anything else you want to mention on the background of this? Any other ghosts you want to talk about, Jason?
I mean, that's just what's so fascinating, right? The more you dig in, the more there is, right? Like, you know, maybe this is more for legacy stuff, but you mentioned Lee Radswell. She did end up releasing the footage that she shot in 2017, and that was called That Summer. You know, all these people who were around them made projects about them. And whether it's the Marble Fawn, Jerry, or, you know, the Lois Wright, the party guest, they all did projects about Grey Gardens because this seems to have like a force of its own, you know, just kind of an energy that people want to keep coming back to, which we even see with the Maysles because they released the Beals of Grey Gardens, which had more footage of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like any documentary, there's always tons of footage that doesn't get used in the final film. And something as famous as this, you end up seeing more of it as time goes on. And we will talk about that more later, I think. But first, we'll come back and get into our general thoughts on Grey Gardens. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1975, we are talking about the documentary Grey Gardens. And Jason, you're so enthused. You're so into this film. What's your favorite thing about the Beals? What makes them so fascinating to you?
Josh, anyone who makes corn in their bed, serves corn in their bed, and talks about how their handyman loves the corn is okay in my book. It just seems like they just keep going with it, and it's nothing is out of the ordinary for them. Like any of them, like, oh yeah, yeah, this is good corn, Big Edie, you know, or whatever. And it's just like, she's literally sitting in a bed with a hot plate next to her, like making corn. And, you know, at one point we see Little Edie like feeding bread to the raccoons in the attic. And this is just like normal for them. So I love that aspect of it. I think they're like, we talked about, like, whether you like it or not, these are very captivating women that you want, that like, you just can't stop watching. And the setting is just so unique. It was those three things that I feel like just really got me and continue to get me with them.
Yeah, I did love that scene where Little Edie goes up into the attic and dumps like an entire loaf of Wonder Bread and an entire box of cat food on the floor to feed. I think maybe the cats are there, but mainly to feed the raccoons. And I thought it was hilarious because you see the raccoons and the movie opens, right? The first thing you really see is Big Edie complaining that the raccoons have made a hole in this wall, right? And so I feel like as a normal person, you assume that the raccoons are a nuisance, right? That they're stuck with the raccoons. They don't want them there, but because the house is dirty or whatever, the raccoons have gotten in. And then you get to that scene and it's a real confirmation of like, no, they are happy with the raccoons. They're feeding the raccoons. They're living in harmony with the raccoons.
And there's something to be said for that, because raccoons are dangerous, man. The raccoons don't ever attack these women. Maybe they love to watch Little Edie dance. Who knows? But, I think she probably became something of like a fashion, maverick there, too. Like people, I could totally see wanting to wear that Little Edie style where she's got those matching outfits and the full head coverings. It's, they're own people.
Yeah. I mean, and again, everything about Little Edie, especially in her fashion sense, seems just like tailor made for drag queens to emulate. And I'm sure you're right that it's a thing that has been done.
Right. And there might have been a medical issue where she she lost her hair, or she might have burned off her own hair. I don't know if we ever.
Yeah, she did have an alopecia. And I mean, at least I watched the narrative film about them, and they delve into that a lot. Whether she also burned it off at some point, she did have a condition that caused her hair to fall out, including like her eyebrows, as we see in the film as well.
Right. Little Edie, we should talk about them because they're both different, right? Little Edie is both resentful, but also doting of her mother. Like she definitely waits on Big Edie hand and foot, right? But she also complains that, you know, Big Edie stole her shot by not letting her continue to live in New York and everything to train to be a dancer. She says, you know, she chased away the only suitor that she ever had, who was like some type of Slovakian count or whatnot, who was 20 years younger, but was the only man that she thought was good enough for her, you know, which was an interesting, Eugene Tchaikovsky was related to so-and-so via such-and-such, and that's why I would have married him. You know, it was, they had to fit in the social circles, right?
Right. And yeah, I mean, it is a weird codependent relationship because on the one hand, Little Edie is doting, and she has lived in this house for all these years. Maybe, and I think she was, however long she was gone for, she's been back for 20.
I think it was like 4 years.
Yeah. So she's basically lived there for almost 50 years, almost the entire time of that. And she keeps saying how she came back to take care of her mother. Her mother was ill or whatever. And you think that that's in a weird way nice, but it does seem that she's resentful. And it also seems in a way that Big Edie is resentful of her daughter, because she is pinning that all like, oh, look at everything that I could have been if I hadn't had to take care of you, mother, if you hadn't made me come back to this house. And then Big Edie is kind of passive aggressively insulting all these men that she claims she could have married or whatever. So it is a weird dynamic.
Yeah, she insults Little Edie's ability to sing. If you're going to sing, right. Sing, right? And Big Edie was a professional singer and, you know, that had that kind of opportunity taken from her. I also got the sense, though, that Big Edie was implying that, you know, there were, whether it was mental issues or whether she was just out of control in New York, that Little Edie had to come back for her own health as well.
Right, right. And again, this is something that's in the narrative film that I don't know how true all that is and how much of it's kind of fictionalized for that. But they do depict the idea of her having this affair with a married man when she was in New York, and the father who was alive at that time, Mr. Beale, who Phelan Beale, who kind of forced her to come back. But, you know, we know his name is Phelan, but I do, one of the weird quirks is I love how both the mother and daughter always refer to him as Mr. Beale.
Right, right. And, but I mean, even all those names, Phelan Beale, and, you know, they're all, and, you know, they all have this like erudite sound to them, but he's not even a thing. Like he left them both like for what, 30 years before this all happened. So, you know, and they mentioned like her two brothers and we never see them. And I think it would have been, I mean, they're so fascinating and captivating, but it would have been interesting to get some other family opinions.
Right. I mean, that kind of goes counter to what the Maisels' whole method is. They're not going to go interview those brothers or whatever somewhere else and get their take on things. But it is interesting. And I think it points, though, to one of the other aspects where Little Edie is like, I had to come back and I couldn't leave. It's like, well, your brothers left. They didn't feel like they had to come back. And maybe part of that is, of course, 19 whatever, 50s, 40s, whenever it was, sexism. But at the same time, part of that is them being willing to make lives for themselves and not be pulled back into the orbit of that mother.
Yeah, there was a codependency. Yeah. There. So,
of course.
You mentioned that technique, the direct cinema technique, which the Maisels were kind of forerunners for here in America, where, you know, they had the portable equipment and the ability to sync sound and video footage at the same time. And this sounds like so like basic to us, but like in the 60s, this was such a new thing.
Right. I mean, the technology didn't exist to make a movie like this, you know, just a little bit earlier. I mean, documentaries could not be made where they would just go into someone's house like this and follow them around and be able to capture everything that they were doing, because it's just the equipment was too cumbersome.
Josh, you know, we see a few other little characters. I mentioned Jerry, the handyman, who Little Edie calls the Marble Fawn. And I love that.
Yes.
And he just, I know he seems to just kind of be like ambling around, and he was a handyman for another socialite and just kind of ended up there. And what did you make of his relationship to the Beals?
I mean, I kind of like that he was so casual. Like you said, that scene where she's cooking the corn, and we as viewers of the movie are like, this is insane. She's lying in bed and she's cooking corn in this hot plate. And he's just so chill. And she's like, you want some corn? He's like, yeah, I'll have some corn. Sure, cool. Sounds good. I like corn, you know? And just the idea that he was this kind of almost like stonery teenager who was just happened to be around and was hanging out with them. So I like that about him. And I think it's hilarious that, you know, to me, it seems like his perspective on them is like, hey, whatever, there are these weird ladies, it's cool, I'll go help them out or whatever. And Little Edie makes this huge deal of the idea that the Marble Fawn is going to move in, right? As you were saying earlier, because she clearly has this deep, deep resentment of the lovers that her mother has had, the live-in lovers. They talk about Gould, her accompanist, who played with her during her music career. And they talk about someone named Tom Logan, who was there for a long time. And these are clearly Big Edie's lovers. And the idea that she thinks that this teenager is going to become the latest lover of her 79-year-old mother is hilarious.
Well, she also at one point claims that Jerry's in love with her, with Little Edie,
yeah.
Right? So, yeah. I had a quote where I think it was his name's Jerry Torrey, said that the Beals showed him a life where he could be himself, explore, and take chances. So I thought that was cool. Like, he was, you know, hey man, I'm here, I'm in it, let's go.
Right. And you know? And I did learn in reading about his later life, he was gay. So he was definitely not in love with either of the Beals. He was not going to be their lover. But it is not surprising that they would be oblivious to that.
Well, I didn't know that either. But I think they still should have let him move in.
Yeah. You're a big fan of the Marble Fawn.
I'm a big fan of all of them, Josh. So yeah. What did you think of that party scene where it was Big Edie's birthday? And then there was like this, you know, very, you know, kind of stuffy man in a suit. And then Lois Wright, who we mentioned earlier, who was another socialite who hosted a public television show in East Hampton. And they were just there and like drinking wine out of paper cups and eating cake. And like Little Edie had to put down newspaper on the seats because they were so dirty. It was an interesting, uncomfortable party right there.
Yeah, that is a very uncomfortable scene. And I think that gives you the sense when you get those outsiders to come in who are also clearly uncomfortable, it gives you the sense of like, yeah, this is, they live in their own little world, but it's not normal. It's very weird and off-putting to people. And maybe Jerry can roll with it, but most people cannot. And so that is an uncomfortable scene.
What, you know, obviously, like I'm here saying like, I love it, it's great. You didn't like it as much as I did. What do you take from this film, Josh?
Yeah. I mean, I think I did find it fascinating and I did find them fascinating. I think as a film, it's very repetitive. At a certain point, my feeling was I kind of get it. I see who these people are. It is crazy. It is fascinating. It's amazing. But I'm just getting more of the same of that, even though this isn't a long film. And it was kind of enough for me. And as fascinating as they are, I would not want to really spend any time with these people. They seem extremely annoying to spend time with in reality. And even that kind of got to me after a while in the film.
Yeah, I mean, they're characters for sure. And I could see, I mean, high maintenance, that might be a way to put yeah. it, right? So, but again, Josh, any woman who just makes corn while You're lying really in bed.
But I mean,
I'm just very impressed.
The place is disgusting. Every so often, because you can see like the beds and the furniture. And it sort of, if you're squinting maybe, or you're not fully focused, it just looks like a slightly dingy house. But every so often the camera moves and you see the floor or you see what looked to me like blood stains on Big Edie's mattress.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm glad I didn't see that.
And maybe that's not what they were, but they were definitely dark. They looked like what would be the color of caked in blood stains. They're like old blood stains. And you just realize how horrific it must be. And that's, I think, what you get across too in that birthday party scene where these people come in and presumably they live in normal houses and they have to spend time here in Grey Gardens. And it's just, it's disgusting. It really is.
Right. So Josh, do you think like, could you like meet them at an In-N-Out Burger? Would that be okay for you?
I mean, I could. I don't know that I would want to. Again, I don't want to hang out. Like, I would not want to go see Little Edie's cabaret show or whatever, or have to have a conversation with her, I don't think.
Well, I know her. She did have a cabaret show that did not do well. But, you know, we should let Dave chime in on the classically trained Big Edie there, who was a renowned recording artist of some type, right, Josh?
I don't know if she was a renowned recording artist, but she did.
She was a professional singer.
She did put on performances with Gould, her accompanist. And I think, yeah, there's a scene where she starts singing. They're playing a record of this old song and she's singing. And she's not in perfect voice, but you can hear, like, this probably was someone who was a good singer. I mean, anyone who's 79 years old is not going to have as strong a voice as they maybe did when they were younger. But you can hear that there was something there. Her voice sounds pretty good, I think.
Yeah. I don't think Little Edie sounds bad. It's just not at the same technique level, I would say.
Yeah. So, Dave, I think you were maybe a little more put off by this even than I was.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciated the movie, and I think it kind of hit home a little bit for me because it reminded me a lot of like the strong personalities of my family in a lot of ways. And like the scene you mentioned earlier with the throwing all the bread on the floor for the raccoons, that's my mom and her five dogs. I mean, her house is just, it's a mess. It's just stuff everywhere. Animals barking, jumping all over each other, and dog food treats everywhere. And I don't know. It just, to me, I was just like, I get enough of this already. I don't need an hour and a half more of it.
Gave you anxiety.
Mm-hmm. A lot of anxiety watching this. Although I will say I didn't think the house was as filthy, I guess, as advertised, so to speak. I've seen some bad houses before. So
I mean, I think the other thing, though, is that this is the cleaned up version of it, right? This is after Jackie and Lee Radziwill spent all this money to get it cleaned up and bring it up to code. And this is what they ended up with.
Yeah. By the way, finally, we get some insight into Dave's familial relationships. After you and I have laid it out there in the past, we can finally get into Dave's therapy here. I'll tell you what scene I feel like is the most haunting to me is Little Edie talks about the Virginia Military Institute and their like music and their marching band. And then we see her just alone dancing and working on this dance, and who knows how long she's been working on it for or how long she continues to do it. But there was just something sad because there was no one there and there was nothing for her or, you know, to get any interaction with at that point. And we know that her mom died just a couple of years later. So, you know, then what happens to her? And I think that's why, like, the connectivity with her and the Maisels, why like this gave them something to look forward to every day. Oh, they're coming over to film. And that just gives us something to sink our teeth into here.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's what you're referring to or it was a different kind of dancer performance, but there's one scene where they're clearly like arriving in the morning and they see her and she says, oh, I didn't sleep at all. I spent 8 hours practicing this. And I don't know if that was that dance or some other song or something, but you're right. It's like, that's all she's doing is probably staying up all night to put together this thing that she can show the Maisels, because that's what she's got going for her, is these guys are going to show up the next day and film some more footage for their movie.
Right. And who knows how many hours she really spent practicing.
Right, right. And but, that's, you know, another thing. You kind of take it all with a grain of salt because she is putting on a performance and is not unaware, I think, of what she's doing or how she might come across. And she wants that flamboyance to come across. So I think the saddest moment to me was the brief shot where you see the cat peeing behind that glorious old portrait of Big Edie from when she was younger. And she was like super glamorous as like this 1920s society woman. And this amazing, you know, commissioned painting or whatever is just leaning against the wall in the bedroom, and the cat is behind it peeing or whatever. And we get a close up on the cat's face, And, you know, I realize the cats don't know what's going on, but I feel like in that moment you could see in the cat's eyes that it was embarrassed to be there.
Really? And Big Edie says, you know, let it do what it wants. At least it's happy or something yeah. like that, right?
So, Dave, you're a cat person. Did you recognize that look in the cat's eyes?
Oh, I know the look of disapproval in cats for sure.
That might be the saddest thing Dave's ever said.
So should we rate this, Jason?
Yeah, I think we have to, Josh. Out of 5 dilapidated mansions.
Sure. Or... That's good. Let's do that.
I gets 4 from me. You guys know how I feel about it, and I can't recommend it any higher than I already have. Like, watch this movie, man.
Yeah, I'm going to give it 3.5. I do think it's a good movie, and it's definitely like an important movie to watch, and it is entertaining. I mean, to me, it lost its charm after a while, but I was mostly entertained by it. So,
and Josh, before Dave jumps in, like, I know we keep, you know, we talk about the condition of it, but we also always talk about like the environment and the space of movies. And what you're seeing here is something that's, like I said, like out of time, out of place. It's such a unique setting too.
Right. I mean, and part of the film is not just the people, but the Maisels do capture that. I mean, they know how to compose shots and to get that, to immerse you in the place where you are. And that is impressive too. So, Dave, how would you rate this?
You know, I gave it 3 on Letterboxd, but I'm actually going to bump it to 3.5. Talking about it here has made me appreciate it even more than I did initially.
All right. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, this cat doesn't disapprove of you, Dave.
We'll come meow. Back in a moment and talk about the legacy of Grey Gardens. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1975, we are talking about the documentary Grey Gardens, and we've gone through some of the legacy here. I mean, we've talked about the career of the Maisels brothers, Albert and David, who were huge documentary filmmakers, and this is the third of their biggest films. Salesman and Gimme Shelter had come before this, but they continued to be successful and prolific. Nothing else really quite as well known as those films, though. David died in 1987, and Albert continued to work for decades after that. He died in 2015. And like I said, that film Iris, which got a lot of renewed attention, that was from 2014. So that was really, you know, late in his career.
And Iris is another fashion icon. So
she is.
That's interesting.
Someone, have you seen that film?
Yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah, so, she's eccentric, but in a less sad way.
Right, and again, that's another New York, you know, a person who means something to New York,
yes.
Right? So, I do you think this is, I think this is probably the most famous of that group, though, right?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like Gimme Shelter, because of the Rolling Stones connection and the endurance of them, it maybe is a little more famous.
Hmm. All right. Well, fair enough, Josh. The address of Grey Gardens is 3 West End Road in Georgia Capon, East Hampton, New York. So if you want to visit it, it is. They sold it to Ben Bradlee, right? The editor of The Washington Post, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Ben Bradlee and his wife bought it and lived there for 35 years. They bought it from Little Edie in 1979, which was 2 years after Big Edie's death. And they lived there for 35 years until 2014, which is when Ben Bradlee died. And then his wife rented it out for a few years and eventually sold it to Liz Lang.
Liz Lang.
Yeah, who's a fashion designer. She bought it in 2017 for $15.5 million.
Mm,
and
see?
I found an article from December 2022 in Veranda Magazine, which is like some sort of architecture interior design magazine, all about Liz Lang's kind of restoration of Grey Gardens. And it's amazing to look at the photos of how it looks now. And it's so, the way she's done it up, it's so colorful, it's so bright, there's so much light in it, it's almost impossible to believe that it is the same house. But of course it is. And she has paid tribute to the Beals in her interior design. She has a painting of Little Edie in her headscarf in the foyer as you come in the house. The second story landing has sculptures, paper mache busts of Big and Little Edie, and there are illustrations of them above the bed in the guest room. And I liked this quote from Liz Lang. She said, "One of the reasons it still feels like an old house is that we forced ourselves not to make it perfect. The floors still creak a little bit, and they're not entirely level, even after all that."
Yeah, I think I like all that stuff. I watch a lot of this, like, kind of, my daughter and I like to watch, like, shows like, you know, Perfect or The Best Vacation Rentals or like Beach Cottage Getaways, and all these beach people are like, "We wanted to leave the house with character, you know, and everything." So I get that. Sally Quinn has been Bradley's wife, Josh, and I believe obviously big figure with the Washington Post. Also, when they bought it, it was for $220,000, which in 2021 would have been the equivalent of $821,000. So they made a pretty penny on this.
Yeah, so that's a huge difference to get it up to $15 million. But of course, I'm sure part of that is not just paying for the house; it's paying for the whole Grey Gardens-ness of
the raccoons.
It,
right?
The raccoons. No, there's a photo in that article of the attic, where it's this beautiful, like, guest room. And it even in the caption is like, "What used to be a raccoon infested attic is now, you know, designed with this toile curtains," or however you pronounce that. And I don't know anything about interior design, but it was just funny that they had to mention the raccoons there still.
Yeah. And Josh, we kind of talked about some of these, and I will continue to talk about some of these other projects, but Jerry Torrey, the Marble Faun of Grey Gardens, there was a documentary called The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens about him, but I don't think either of us have been able to find that in any way. He became a sculptor. He was a taxi cab driver. You know, he seems to have lived a full life there.
Yeah, that documentary from 2011, I don't know if it was ever released or aired or at film festivals or whatever, but it is definitely not available anywhere. But he, in 2018, also wrote a memoir also called The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. And just a couple months ago, in March 2023, he signed a deal to make a film adaptation, a narrative film adaptation of that. So the interest level is still there for something attached or connected to Grey Gardens.
Do we know who's making that film?
I mean, I think there was some names of producers, but it was no one that I'd heard of that was listed there.
Well, Josh, you did watch the narrative version of the film, which starred Drew Barrymore and Jessica Lange and was an HBO movie. Won a ton of, it was nominated for 17 Emmys and won 6, including Outstanding Made-for-Television Movie, Lead Actress in a Movie or Miniseries for Lang, and Outstanding Supporting Actor for, who was
it? It's Ken Howard, who plays Phelan Beale. He plays Mr. Beale.
Right. And then Drew Barrymore, I think, won for Best Actress in a Miniseries or Television Film for the Golden Globe, and also that movie won for the Golden Globe for Best Miniseries or Made for Television Movie.
Yeah, it's from 2009, directed by Michael Suksi. I don't know. So many names to mispronounce in this episode. But Drew Barrymore is great in it. And I mean, Jessica Lange, of course, is great, but I feel like Drew Barrymore is not always known for being like a spectacular actor, and especially not known for being like immersed in her roles. I feel like when you enjoy watching Drew Barrymore, it's because she's being Drew Barrymore, kind of, you know, like in the Charlie's Angels movies or something, which I know, Jason, are your favorites.
I like the first
one. Yeah, well, that's a whole extra topic. But she's really, really good. She's played Little Edie, and it doesn't just kind of reenact the documentary. I mean, it more uses the documentary as kind of a framing device and tells the story of their lives going all the way back to the 1930s. So when Little Edie was young and all that stuff about moving to New York and trying to find suitors and becoming a debutante and wanting to audition for shows as an actress and a dancer and all of that. And then her having to come back and her relationship with her father and the brothers. And it's a whole odyssey of their lives, including the documentary and including then a little bit after the documentary is finished. So it is a bit, you know, biopic-y. And there are definitely moments where there's like, "Oh, remember this memorable thing that they said in the documentary? What if we showed you a moment earlier in their lives where they said that the first time?" And you're like, "Hey, I remember that, you know?" So Little Edie calling herself a staunch character or whatever, you got to get the scene of someone telling her that she is, so we know where it came from or something.
So how many dilapidated mansions do you give that?
I mean, I gave it a 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd. It's pretty good. I mean, I think you would be interested in it as a big fan of the documentary. I don't think it's, you know, it's not a replacement for the real thing, but it does make an effort to put them in context, which is not something that the Maisels really do, and give you a sense of who they were before this and kind of how they ended up where they are.
And we did talk about The Beals of Grey Garden, which was the released sequel, I guess you would call it, but which is just more footage from what the Maisels had already shown.
Yeah, Albert Maisels, that was in 2006, so after David's death, but he co-directed that. And I haven't seen that, but yeah, it is mainly just kind of put together with footage that they didn't use. And the same goes for that movie that you mentioned from 2017, That Summer. And that is the footage that was lost for a really, really long time from 1972 that Lee Radziwill had commissioned and was put together into a film by a Swedish director named Göran Olsson. And I have not seen that either.
Lois Wright, who we mentioned as the party guest, was a famed public television show host on The Hamptons, which already just makes, like, what a great title for a job. And her book was called My Life at Grey Gardens, 13 Months and Beyond. So like we said, everyone's doing projects about this. I did want to mention, Josh, we mentioned the co-directors, Ellen Hovde, who both edited Gimme Shelter and Salesman, and Muffy Meyer went on to make shorts for Sesame Street, and she made Going Broke in America. So good stuff.
Yeah, the two of them had their own production company, worked together. They did a lot of educational documentaries for PBS over many decades. In addition to that TV movie, the other adaptation that was highly successful and highly awarded is the Broadway musical that premiered in 2006. It was nominated for 10 Tonys, and it won three of them, including for the main actors, Christina Ebersole and Mary Louise Wilson. It also won for its costume design and had various revivals as recently as 2016.
And Josh, there was a documentary made about Grey Gardens, the musical, called Grey Gardens from East Hampton to Broadway. So
Grey Gardens, the musical, the documentary. Or Grey
Gardens, it's a cottage
documentary,
industry.
The musical, the documentary.
Right. It's just a cottage industry here, this this whole thing. I wanted to say, Big Edie, this is what I read, that like on her deathbed, Little Edie asked her if there was anything else she wanted to say. And she said, there's nothing more to say. It's all in the film.
Yeah. And they actually use that in the narrative movie, not in that context, but they have a New York Times reporter call her and say, do you want to comment on the movie? And she says, it's all in the film. So they kind of repurpose all that in that movie.
Josh, one more question. You ever have a midnight tryst with a ghost?
No, I have not. Have you?
No, but I don't really have anything else to add unless Dave has ghost cats looking at him disapprovingly.
Dave, what is the impact of this film on the cat owning community?
Oh God, you ask jokingly, but I mean, look at this movie. This is a cat lover's movie. So.
And a raccoon lover's movie, yes. I suppose.
So. Yeah.
Has your mom seen this?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I would imagine so. And her sister, my Aunt Wendy, who is way crazier than my mom, she must love this movie very much, like these people.
Oh, wow. That's
the next movie that involves animals in such a way, Josh. I think we have to have Sonny Rosen as a guest on it.
I'm kind of afraid of that. So that is Grey Gardens, and that is this episode of Awesome Movie Year. Check us out online and on social media.
Well, you could have your big shot of talking to us on all the socials if you just go on awesomemovieyear.com. We're there. Of course, you can go to the platforms, Awesome Movie Year on Facebook and Instagram, Awesome Movie Pod on Twitter. I'm Jason Harris Comedy, or J. Harris Comedy and all the things. Eat This Comedy is still a thing. Go for Jason on Letterboxd.
I'm at joshbellhateseverything.com. Some stuff is there. Not great. But more at Josh Bell Hates Everything on Facebook, at Signal Bleed on Twitter, and at Signal Bleed on Letterboxd. And listen to our producer David Rosen's awesome podcast, Piecing It Together.
Check out Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. And at the time that this goes up, I will have just launched a special pre-order for a novelty album of songs about my pets called The Pup Pups, which I feel like is something that Little Edie would appreciate.
She would.
Dude, I appreciate that. That's great.
So, Jason, what are we doing in our next episode?
Josh, it's your pick. You tell us.
I will. It is The Stepford Wives, the adaptation of the Ira Levin novel, which is a favorite of mine. And hopefully it will be for you guys as well. So tune in next time for The Stepford Wives. And thanks for listening to Awesome Movie Year.
Thank you for listening to Awesome Movie Year. Make sure to follow Awesome Movie Year on Facebook, at Awesome Movie Pod on Twitter, and at Awesome Movie Year on Instagram. And if you like the show, review us and rate us with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
An All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.
Thanks for listening to Awesome Movie Here!